All right, this is session number 46, recorded on July 23rd, 2007. We are continuing with my book titled Fatty Communion with Bob Dobbs. We've done the LaRouche section, the McLuhan section, the William Irwin Thompson section, and the Croker section. And we finished up by going back and cleaning up the leftover parts at the end of the LaRouche section. And while doing that, relating him to the other three people. So the fifth part of the book is me. And the book itself has transcripts of different shows that I did through the years. And those transcripts were made by Dave Neufeld, who produced the famous Broken Social Scene album. Neufeld, who made the Bob's Meat Ecology albums, he got those tapes to make the albums from Nelson Thal, and to get a handle on all the data in the radio excerpts that Nelson gave him, he had to type it all out. So when I put the book together in the fall of 91, after finishing being on CKLN from 87 to 91, I was thinking about how would I present my stuff, and then Dave told me he had transcribed all the tapes, so that made it easy for me. I took his transcriptions and put them in the book. Now, those transcriptions are posted on Five Bodied in the, I don't know which section that is, in. It's in the permanent archive zone under maybe interviews with Bob or essays by Bob, maybe that's the section it's in. And so rather than reading that stuff, the transcripts that are in my book, and you can hear a lot of those transcripts on the albums, Bob's Meat Ecology and Bob's Meat Ecology Squared, and if you go to the audio archive, you can hear the shows that a lot of it was taken from. So we don't need to do that part in my book. So what we're going to do is we're going to analyze all my charts. Not all of them are my charts, but charts that are featured on the fivebody.com site under chart and image. Is it archives, Scott? Is that what it says? Chart and image archive?
Let me take a look here.
If you look at the front page of fivebody.com, you'll see the chat line's called Being Five Bodied, and then there's audio interviews, then there's essays and out of this world sections. At the bottom it says chart and image.
Chart and image archive.
Archive.
Click
and
on so, that, and then there's a list of your charts.
Of the charts. So we're going to start off doing what's called the top-down chart on the site there, and then the bottom-up chart, and then we'll do the Bob Dobbs formula chart, and then the famous one, the tiny note chart, which is the one that most people know about. Now, the first two charts are not done by me. They were made by Bob Marshall. Now, he made these, he made them for himself, but Nelson Thal used them, made a copy of them, and presented them in Nelson Thal's newsletter called The Perfect Pitch, which was put out three little issues. One was April 22nd, 1985. Second one was July 22nd, 1985. The 22 dates, obviously, being intentional. And the third one was done a year later on September 22nd, 1986. So these three newsletters are made up of quotations, interesting quotations from the different holy offices. Now, Bob Marshall was like a student of mine in that period, and he was doing his International Connection show, and he needed to organize all this. So he had a problem with what was top-down and what was bottom-up and what was the difference. So he made two charts based on what I was saying, and I kind of guided him in the charts, but he created the nomenclature. So we're looking at Bob Marshall's attempt to organize all the information I was dumping on him from 83 to 85. And he started the radio show in last week of August 1984 is when the International Connection started. And I had met him in late 83 at a party in Toronto, and he was a budding journalist, so I thought he'd be a good guy to groom and I had the intention of getting him in public somehow. I was aware of CKLN, and so I probably had that in mind. So what we got here in these charts is Bob Marshall trying to figure out how to relate, let's say, for bottom-up, the McLuhan information versus the top-down LaRouche information. So along with LaRouche goes Maybrussel, and along with McLuhan goes Croker. All right, so one thing we should say that these tapes, this session and subsequent sessions, are being taped differently. So, Scott, do you want to explain what we're doing differently?
Yeah, well, up through session 1 through 45, we were the telephone was going on to the tape recorder, and at the end of every session when the tape ran out, we would just get sort of cut off in mid-sentence. Now we're recording directly to a digital medium, so that doesn't run out. But we are going to take a break every 44, well, at the 44-minute mark, which is about when we were taking the break on the tape. And
if we are going along and you see that it is the 44-minute mark, but we're still saying something important,
we'll finish up.
Yeah, and then
take a break at an appropriate time.
So it may not be exactly 44 minutes like the other ones, like the previous 45 sessions.
Right.
And there'll still be two sides, but we're not calling it sides, we're calling it parts now.
Yeah. Part one, part A, and part B.
Yeah. So that's the new technology, and all this stuff will be up on our website someday.
Yeah, before too long.
Yeah. So, all right, so we're going to go into, if you're listening to this and you go on your computer, you go into the chart and image archive, and draw up the top-down chart, and you'll be looking at what we're looking at. So what Bob Marshall did, if you look at this top-down, bottom-up chart, is you at the very top you see in capital letters the word ground, and that's on the top left. And then there's a longer section stretching from the ground, but separate from the ground, called figures. So what Bob Marshall meant was that in the column under ground is the technological communication technology of the historical period. And that was the ground. That determined many kinds of social activities. The figures are the various social activities. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 columns under the capitalized word figures, which are all determined by the ground, determined as much as one believes in determination. So you see that, Scott? You see how it's organized?
Yeah.
Now, did you know that from looking at charts before?
Yeah, I noticed that.
Right. So what you have under the figures, you got 6 divisions. First is the popular art form. The next one's highbrow art form, and the next one is technological art form. Now, the reason they're called art form is that usually the ground technology is invisible. And so people see the effects of the previous technology. And under the impact of the new hidden environment, this is basic McLuhan knowledge, which we've probably discussed a lot in the McLuhan section of the book when we're doing the McLuhan quotes, what is seen in the past is, in a way, in a very general meaning, is an art form. It's the massaging of what now is knowable and cognizable and visible and recognizable, and so people use it as a repository of their cultural, spiritual, moral values, whatever values the culture has, you know, and they differ in history in different cultures. And that is all as a result of the action going on in a hidden ground. And so they're not seeing the effects of the present. They're not seeing what's causing the effects of the present. And the effects of the present is what people see and notice and call an art form, or we in retrospect would call an art form. So we have here the content art forms is the lowbrow culture, so to speak, which we call the popular art form. And the within the content world, there's the highbrow or high culture form. So that's the highbrow art form. So you got the Western division between art forms laid out here, popular and highbrow. But also, even though cultures weren't fully aware of it, a previous technological ground has become art form. So it's the form, the art form of the previous ground, or the art form of the form, as opposed to the art form of the content in the culture. So the content is popular art form and highbrow art form, and then the formal art form, which is now visible, previously a ground, is under the column technological art form. All right? Now the next three titles are popular archetype, ghetto, and symptoms. The reason the word archetype is there is that McLuhan laid out, and this is all stuff that I told Bob Marshall, and he processed it, and after a while figured out a way to organize it. Since McLuhan gives, like, the history of human culture, you kind of retrace the stages of what he presented and create your own chart or history of cultural shifts. So McLuhan laid out the pattern that when a new technology or communication form is having its invisible effect, it's the last word. It's exciting people, and they're not fully cognizant of all the properties or effects that what is exciting them is going to have on them. So that's called the last word, and then McLuhan says after people get used to that environment and then it becomes normal, it becomes what he calls cliche. And then when a new environment, a new last word comes in, it turns a cliche into an art form. Sort of like a deeper, more collective memory or cultural pattern or habit. Even you could call a meme, though it's based on materiality. Then, after the art form has been around for a long time, maybe hundreds of years, millennia, that technological content and form, then it becomes McLuhan's fourth phase, archetype, which is something deeper and wider than art form. So I think these four phases, last word, cliche, art form, and archetype, were coined by Howard Gossage, who was the ad man in San Francisco who first promoted McLuhan in the 65 period, 1965. Got him in magazines and all that. I think there's an essay in McLuhan's book, or in the book on McLuhan called Hot and Cool. There's an essay by Gossage, and if I recall, it was in there where he spells out that pattern. Now, that was probably his way of processing what McLuhan was saying to him, those four phases. I don't know if it was literally said by McLuhan, but it's very useful. So we're now talking in the fourth column to the right, under figures, popular archetype. That's beyond art form. So the first three are art forms, and then you have the archetype, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And when it's archetype, I have in brackets the user as monarch of. It's so much of a shared environment that everybody thinks it's theirs, or that it's in quotes, free, or everybody takes for granted. All right? And then you have ghetto. That refers to something that's kind of missing or obsolete or subject to violence or abandonment. It's a part of the past that the new environment is making a figure, but it's not developed as an art form. It's not seen as a repository of spiritual and cultural values, though that's not exactly what I mean, but approximately it's maybe like a very ancient archetypal form that is abused or archetypalized in another sense. But for some reason, Bob Marshall called it ghetto. And then the final column to the right under figures, or another way of tabulating figures, is a column called symptoms. And so these would be human expressions of identity crisis, let's say, as a result of the new ground and as part of the social action responding to the new ground and trying to retrieve an old identity. So that's what the chart means, as Bob Marshall had it organized. Any questions about that?
Yeah. after the word ground, there's a line, and then the word figures.
Yeah.
And under the line is, for ground, is the phonetic alphabet and popular art form. I was wondering if popular art form is supposed to be considered part of the ground or part of the figure.
No, art form is ground. I mean, it's figure. Remember I said the word for ground in Howard Gossage's formula, the fourfold last word, cliche, art form, archetype, last word is his word for ground. Something is exciting people.
Mm-hmm.
It's involving them, and yet they don't fully know what's going on. It could be the first figure, and that's what people are excited by is not the ground, but the ground has hoiked up something that they do become excited about.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say, now this is Bob's terms, Bob Marshall's terms, and so they're not totally what I would say, but it's a useful chart to take a massive of information and put it in some kind of order. So we're going to go through the content of the chart, and I think you'll be understood better what I'm saying.
So the first column is the ground. The first vertical column is the ground.
Yeah, that's the ground. That's
the other
new environment.
The other six columns are all figures.
The past. They are the past. But
yeah,
they have a resume.
But the reason why they're called figures is because they're what everybody is talking about.
It's people what they can see now.
Yeah, and they're not. People aren't really talking about the ground because it's massaging them from behind the scenes.
Yeah, it's invisible. People don't know, can't see the present.
Mm-hmm.
That's what McLuhan's point was. It wasn't until the 20th century we had such speed up of change in technological grounds that people started to notice dimly the changing effects of it.
Mm-hmm.
But back 2,000 years ago, change was too slow for cultures to notice it.
Yeah, right. And like, well, you said earlier that it could take hundreds of years to go from art form to
archetype.
But that's back when we're beginning this chart. Today, well, in recent times, it could take a few years, a few months, a few days, or maybe no time at all.
Well, you got Moore's Law, 18 months.
Yeah.
Moore's Law,
Every
18 months there's a major shift.
Yeah. So it may be by the time we finish up with this chart, move to the formula and the tiny note chart, we'll be in the sphere where actually we're not even rotating through these processes anymore, or they're going so fast you can't even talk in terms of timelines.
Yeah, well, the tiny note chart is showing the Android meme going through these phases, and there's no more phases for humans.
Oh, okay.
After the satellite, there's no more phases. By 1960, the tiny note chart goes from 60 to 90, 1960, 1990, and it's about the Android meme simulating the changes that these two early charts, top-down and bottom-up, happened during the human period.
Yeah. That's a little difficult to grok right now, but we're going to build up.
Yeah, that's what we're going to lead towards, understanding that. Now, if you look on the chart, on the far left it says Global Village. Let me read the grounds and before I go into that. And then below that it says Global Theater. But to explain that, under the ground you have phonetic alphabet and papyrus. So that's from 500, 400 B.C. into, well, it goes up to print. The next level chart is 2,000 years later. 1500 A.D. when Gutenberg brought in print, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a 2,000 year gap between the beginning of the phonetic alphabet new effect and then the next new effect, the printing press. So then after the printing press, you get into the Industrial Revolution, which is about 350 years later. And then the Electronic Revolution, as Bob Marshall meant it, it goes up to about 1945. And that's why he calls it Global Village. The Global Village starts to come in with the printing press. That's when the Europe moves across the planet and starts creating its colonies, right?
Mm-hmm.
With its shipping and advanced navigation techniques and compasses and all that. It was able to, even though it took them months to get around the world, that was a lot faster than anybody tried to walk around it any time before 1500. So, and then you have the Industrial Revolution, including the telegraph, shrinks the planet even more, and then radio. say radio, up to radio, is the Global Village. So there's been a Global Village effect, but speeded up and more obvious in terms of access to distance from 2500 BC to 1945, 1950, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the Global Village phase. After, when you get to television, computer, satellite, and Second Coming, as the next four phases underneath the ground column, that's the global theater effect. That's the beginning of moving into what technically is caused by the satellite. All right? So there's a difference between the Global Village and the Global Theater, at least as Bob Marshall understood it. And it's not wrong. It's just pretty good. All right?
Right.
Okay, so now, if we look at the phonetic alphabet as a ground, what is the popular art form? Well, he put in Christ, meaning Jesus Christ or the Nazarene, and he put in his highbrow art form.
Yeah, now, that dates it to the phonetic alphabet is...
Okay, it's 400 years later.
Yeah.
And highbrow art form is Plato and Aristotle, but they're 350 years before Christ.
Right.
That's if there was a Christ, but I'm assuming there was. Technological art form is the spoken word. The popular archetype is the tribe. The ghetto or dropout is the family. And the symptoms of the phonetic alphabet and papyrus is the Roman Empire, symbolized by Caesar.
So that means that Caesar is the symptom is being locked down during this period. So
right.
Caesar's being locked down.
Yeah, I don't know what Bob Marshall meant exactly, but it's a maybe the politics or the fight over power.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly the top down zone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the image of power. I mean, the Roman Empire was new. It centralized over vast stretches of horizontal space. You know what I mean? It wasn't what Harold Innes called a time-based civilization. The time-based, like Egypt and Babylonian China, they didn't necessarily want to conquer huge, vast tracts of land horizontally out. It's only with the phonetic alphabet where you in the mobile papyrus that you were able to organize people over vast distances through the speeded-up technology of roads and paper messages.
Mm-hmm.
The slower manuscripts, the slower forms of clay and stone, not manuscripts, but clay and stone, that the time-based societies had, didn't encourage the speed-up that you needed to have that new kind of phenomenon known as the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So the phonetic alphabet and papyrus were the technological ground that allowed that new kind of phenomenon. Alexander the Great started it, tried to do it, but he didn't have the technology and structure and roads that Rome later had to lock it down.
Mm-hmm.
So Caesar is the Caesar phenomenon, the emperor. I mean, it could be any Caesar.
Right.
It could be Julius Caesar or any other those guys.
Right. So it's worth mentioning that there's vast tracts of time and cultural development that precede this chart. But this chart begins with the phonetic alphabet and linear time-based geography conquering
right.
culture.
Because to understand the effect of the phonetic alphabet, which would lead to the generation of a Western culture that was totally different from every other culture, eventually with the printing press, the development of the individual, you see the beginnings of that, the glimpses of it in Greece, but that's due to the phonetic alphabet. So the phonetic alphabet is the unforeseen virus that creates a different phenomenon in the West from the rest of the world. As McLuhan used to say in the 70s, North Americans go out to be alone and go home to be social. Every other culture in the world has always, and continues, well, maybe not today, but in his time, go out to be social and go home to be alone. So... that was part of the development of Western culture, but exaggerated in the wilderness of North America.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a uniqueness to the West, and we don't mean in better, it just it's different. And McLuhan called it civilization, but he meant a technical term. It was the beginning of visual space.
you know.
So we begin with visual space. Now you look under...
Well, we begin with visual space once it concresses to a certain degree, because visual space was already developing before Plato and Aristotle in the Homeric times.
Yeah, there was writing. And there were syllabary, civilizations had it before, but it's the effect of the phonetic alphabet, McLuhan maintains, that made something different.
Yeah, so like, for instance, how do we distinguish between the visual space of Homer and the visual space of Plato and Aristotle?
The phonetic alphabet. The phonetic alphabet, the fact that Greeks took the vowels out of the consonantal script and separated A, E, I, O, and U, created that isolated zone, that was the beginning of an abstract space that was due to this phonetic effect.
I wonder if the number zero was discovered around the same time.
No, zero was discovered by India, say around, I don't know, 800, 900 A.D., and McLuhan explains that is that because the Indian culture was tactile and understood the resonating interval, what's called the void. It wasn't an empty void. But when they took that implicit cultural bias of tactility and acoustic space and then encountered the phonetic alphabet, the hybrid came up with the idea of zero.
Actually,
it was the Arabs, but I think India was first part of it. But the Arabs invented zero. I think it was called Zephyr. And the if I remember, I'm a bit hazy on this, haven't thought of it in a long time, but the meeting of East and West under visual space conditions brought in the effect of the Arab culture and their projection into it, came up with the concept of zero.
And that was about
after Christ.
About 800 AD?
Somewhere like that, yeah. I think that it's during the Arab Renaissance, which is like 800. It's the Islamic Revolution, Islamic religion has started. That's 700 A.D. And then as they developed this glorious culture in Baghdad and that, the scholars came up with the concept of zero.
Yeah.
And then there was the whole mathematic they developed. And then so they brought that to the West. I don't know, but...
So the void that was created by the vowels, bringing the vowels in.
An empty void, vibrating void of the Asian.
Well, the empty void was the hidden ground. It's probably when it becomes figure that all of a sudden zero becomes used as a figure in mathematics.
Yeah, now the zero comes out of the Arab Renaissance, and I in my mind there's some input from India there. I can't forget what that is. But the... that is during the Dark Ages for Europe.
Yeah, because India didn't have the phonetic alphabet at that time, did they?
I know, but they were starting to encounter the West. And so, remember, cultures bring their assumptions to a new medium, and they mutate it.
Well, plus, they were looking at the abstract void of the West and trying to figure out what it was, so it was becoming more of a figure for them rather than a ground. And then they came up with zero.
Yeah, they adapted it with their input. They translated the zero, the void of visual space, in mathematics and came up with zero.
Yeah.
And in my mind, the word zero comes from Zephyr or something like that. So that's the Arabic culture. But for some reason, read Bob Logan's book, which he co-wrote with McLuhan, but then it never got published when McLuhan was alive, and then it was published after McLuhan died. And that was about 1986. It's called Alphabet, Mother of Invention. That goes in detail through this McLuhan-esque history.
Mm.
We're not saying it's true, but it is the consistent pattern of thinking that McLuhan developed, and it's, in quotes, a system of thinking, system of philosophy or knowledge, and I'm just telling you how McLuhan interpreted history, and he looked for evidence, and he used Eric Havelock's preface to Plato is a big big book to support his idea about the effect of the phonetic alphabet. And Havelock was a friend, colleague of Harold Innes, and all this comes out of Harold Innes, a lot of it. But McLuhan got stuff before that from Wyndham Lewis, who had a big influence on James Joyce and Harold Innes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the fact of Wyndham Lewis influencing Innes just came out in a new biography of Innes, which was a... the University of Toronto or some Canadian student in Ontario did a PhD on Innis and did that like 25 years ago, and then he finally got it published recently, last year or two. And so he had access to some of the unpublished papers of Innis, and that's where this new information about Wyndham Lewis, who had been a big influence on McLuhan. And then McLuhan has an interesting interaction with Innis, and Innis is an influence on McLuhan. And I don't think either of them knew that Innis, McLuhan probably did not know that Innis was influenced by Lewis. So Lewis is the founder of media ecology. That's something I'll be talking about more over the next while in public. It's not known at all.
Mm-hmm.
I
was just listening to Who's Forgotten Furry Linton. There's actually a sound clip of McLuhan tipping his hat to Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah.
So he's talking about where he got it from. They asked the interviewers, where'd you get it from? He said, from Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah, so people should listen to Furry Lint if they haven't yet.
Right. Now, why was I going into... So McLuhan... So this is Bob Marshall trying to figure out, organize McLuhan's view of history, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's looking at all the figures, the action in society across the different institutions and cultural events, and saying, okay, these are being affected by hidden ground, but you can see why certain figures rise up. So we have in the ghetto, you have family. This is under phonetic alphabet and papyrus in the same column across. The family is maybe the original social institution, maybe pre-tribe.
Yeah, I don't think it's. I don't think it's fair to call them ghetto.
Wait. You don't know. We'll get to that.
Okay.
Yes, it is fair if you know what he means. The family being the original technology, or at least the way humans organize themselves. You then, as families got together, you know, thousands of years ago, they formed clans and tribes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the tribe is before Greek individualist effect. So the tribe is an old technology which becomes an art form as you move into the individualizing effect of the phonetic alphabet, all right?
Yeah.
So the oral group mind of the tribe becomes archetype. And since the writing was coming in for thousands of years before the phonetic alphabet, that is the beginning of a not so intensely tactile oral culture, which is the tribal phenomenon. So in the pre-alphabet writing phases, the tribe is the art form. All right? And the time-based Babylonian empires are the ground. So when you move into the visual space effect, the tribe, which was art form, becomes archetype. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But before, meaning it's kind of older, but before that, the pre-tribal organization, the family, that's way back, it becomes kind of...
I think that's backwards. It seems tribe before we had the
family.
Don't
give your opinion until you hear the whole... I'm trying to explain it, anticipate what you're going to say, and then you fill in anything.
Right.
So the family is way back there, and it's kind of like a big trouble. It's hardly have an identity. People have families, but their identity is more towards the tribe. And then when they get into the Greek culture, it's more towards individual ideal values. Idea and ideal.
Represented by Plato and Aristotle.
Right. So what you have is in the visual effect and visual ground of phonetic alphabet, what's going to be the art form? It's going to be oral communication, the speech technologies, and the beginning of organizing ideas which come out of speech interaction. So the cultural, non-religious version of that is the highbrow art form, and that's Plato and Aristotle, Plato turned the oral form into an art form in the sense that the Socratic dialogues with people interacting and speaking with some kind of metaphysical intent, right?
Yeah.
It wasn't casual speaking. It wasn't taken for granted ground. It was orchestrated and manipulated to create some kind of values, which values were for individual insight and that would reflect the individuating effect of the phonetic alphabet. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So the highbrow non-religious art form is Plato and Aristotle. Now, what's interesting, if you consider Christ a religious figure, and most people do, some people think he was a philosopher, but let's say take him as a religious figure, what did he represent? The divine family, or the holy family. He is taking that ancient form, the family, and in a sense archetypalizing it as an image within his matrix, but he also is doing speech as art form, he's doing parables, he's a philosopher, he's interacting with the people, but it is more of a pop culture thing. He's out there in the market. He's not a school like Plato and Aristotle. He's not an academy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a populist, so to speak, or a communist, or socialist, or what's called primitive Christianity. He was out there interacting with people, with fishermen and prostitutes and all those archetypal figures, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he was creating an emotion. So let's call that, or Bob Marshall called it, a popular art form. You see the difference?
Yeah.
So now they both, Plato and Aristotle and Christ, were under the, as it says under the technological art form, they were taking the spoken word and making it a figure containing conscious aesthetic or spiritual values imparted in it, or intellectual values. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so the archetype is tribe. The ghetto is the original way back their family. And within the time of Christ and Plato and Aristotle, actually Plato and Aristotle a little before, can't really say there were Caesars in his time, but it was coming, and because this is a span of time from 500 BC to 1500 AD, you can lump in these syndromes that are not chronologically matchable, not happening at the same time, but they're all within the same effects. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there's the Caesar. So that's what that means. He saw Christ, and so you look at back then, and your memory has Christ and Plato, if you even think of it, spoken word, tribe, family, and Caesar. You might have those cliche images, but to put them in a figure-ground relationship and make it almost a science, which will indicate how to make later developments into the same pattern, that's what is x-rayed here. That's the x-ray that Bob Marshall presented. Okay?
Yeah. So it seemed like if spoken word was a technological art form, you'd have all kinds of poets and people talking about stuff, that's where...
Well, that's the Hellenic culture. That's pre-Aristotle, the Thales and those first philosophers out of the Ionian culture, 600, 700 BC, and then the Sophists and the other schools of thought, the Epicureans and the Cynics, all these things were running around at the time of Plato, and then following him into 200 BC, 100 BC, right? It's all kinds of schools. That's all the spoken word's art form.
Yeah, so
Now remember, it says here, the way this is, I'm looking at the original newsletter, The Perfect Pitch. It has identity, hyphen, the culture hero, in brackets, in the West. This is only in the West.
Right.
And so the bottom up, Bob Marshall doesn't even have the phrase bottom up on the original presentation of the chart. Just says we're looking at identity, and this is the culture hero in the West, and why certain people are culture heroes and others aren't, and it's due to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in the West,
right?
Which is a unique phenomenon due to the phonetic effect.
Right.
I mean, the West created the global village. China, around 1400, 1500 AD, they had a huge armada, and they went as far as Africa, and then for some reason retreated, right around the time of Columbus. But for some reason, Europe kept going and spread out around the planet. China withdrew into its imperial, isolated culture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's move along here. So the next...
I'm not sure you addressed my... to me, the tribe comes before the family.
Bob Marshall is presenting the family first. Now, if you don't agree with that, then it doesn't work. But he thinks that And McLuhan says that there was a form of awareness before the tribe. And I mean, if you read McLuhan, you got to read a lot of stuff and read obscure stuff to find this fact. But Bob Marshall had the luck of talking to me, and I told him a lot of things that most people wouldn't get, because I'm one of the best teachers of McLuhan in the world, so I'll tell you a lot faster. So McLuhan said that before tribal awareness, there was a individual awareness, private man, but not literate private, but just an isolated man. So he, assuming that, the isolated man would have a small social unit, which would be its mate and children. So if you don't think of the tribe as the beginning form, and you're using McLuhan, you think of the private, this isolated individual.
Well, I remember hearing some cultural anthropologist somewhere stating his belief that during the tribal period, people used to just have, you know, big group orgies, and nobody knew whose kid was who, and
right.
The kids were raised by the tribe, and so the sense of the family hadn't really emerged yet. There wasn't a sense of property.
Yeah, but he's assuming people began as tribes. McLuhan assumed people began as isolated individuals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we don't have to agree with that, but this is Bob Marshall trying to put McLuhan into a chart form.
Right.
Okay, so, I mean, he named himself. Bob Marshall's not his real name. He named himself after Marshall McLuhan when he went on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Marshall.
Yeah.
So he's taking the family as the original form, and it's a ghetto once the technology of the tribal behavior happened.
Right.
And that came in, you know, thousand years ago, and then you had the weird effects you just talked about, and like Terence McKenna romanticizes that period in a way.
Yeah.
Everybody stoned and raving away. That is before the distinguishing features of each individual that writing would start to bring out, before the phonetic alphabet.
Mm-hmm. So McLuhan thought that man, right from the get-go, was an isolated self-awareness.
Yeah, autonomous self-aware phenomenon.
Does he feel that there was a transition from the animal kingdom into the human kingdom when that happened? Or
yeah, well, that's you're asking me. I'm not going to go into me, but he felt, and Wyndham Lewis indicated this, when he wrote an essay called "The Artist is Older Than the Fish."
Oh.
That's an interesting statement.
Mm-hmm.
So human consciousness goes way back before any forms that we think of as social. And, I mean, early caveman, once he's conscious, sort of a Homo sapiens sapiens, I think is the category, he's wandering around surviving. You know, there may have been no way to cohere people. They didn't have much speech.
Mm-hmm.
So speech brings in the tribal effect.
Hmm.
And it has an oral bias, so then you have an oral complex.
Yeah.
So
I wonder if he sees human consciousness having emerged from the animal kingdom at all, or if it was started by...
Wait, are you asking a question?
Yeah.
And you're wondering if...
Yeah, if Marshall saw the human awareness as evolving out of the animal kingdom, or if it began through some other process.
Yeah, I don't know what he, as a Catholic, maybe they didn't agree with Darwin too much, so I doubt if he took Darwin literally. He might include some of it, but I don't know. That would get into talking to McLuhan personally. He does write about Darwin as an effect of, he said Darwin got his evolution of species from Ovid's Metamorphoses. Ovid, around the time of Christ.
Uh-huh.
Greek poet. No, Roman poet, I guess. And his famous book, Metamorphoses, which had a big influence on Joyce, Eliot, and people through history. Ovid's Metamorphoses is organized in 15 sections, I think, and Darwin's Origin of Species is in 15 sections. Anyways, I haven't checked that out in a long time, but I recall McLuhan saying that in an article, that he thought Darwin got his idea from, because Darwin was a Christian, and was troubled by his own theory, that Darwin got his ideas, his kind of the mutating of form, human form, animal form, came from the idea of metamorphoses. Now, that may not be true, but that was McLuhan's take. So the point is that he was seeing Darwin as a metaphor almost.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know how literally McLuhan took Darwin. Certainly Wyndham Lewis had a big influence on McLuhan, made fun of Darwin. He wrote a whole book about the effect of Darwin called Time and Western Man. Very, very important book for understanding McLuhan. McLuhan gets so much out of Lewis that's in that book. Time and Western Man came out in 1927, and that was a book that James Joyce bounced off of in, as he was writing Finnegan's Wake.
Right.
So let's go through these.
Okay, so you heard the timer. Why don't we take a break? And then there's a couple other observations I want to make about this column before we move to the next one.
So the ghetto thing, that's put in by Bob Marshall to make you think, because most people think we began with the tribe.
Right.
But when you look at it, you don't really know why it's family until you read the rest of the chart. I mean, you don't know that family is before tribe unless you read the rest of it, but we'll get to that.
Okay.
Okay. We'll take a break.
Okay.